Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And I just wowed Bob. I just took my windbreaker off, and I am wearing safety cone.
Whoa, that is
orange.
I wondered why my glasses all of a sudden auto-darkened.
I know. I did it. I did it because we're talking about terrorism, so you know what?
There you go.
On behalf of the team,
You're a target.
I'm the target.
Yeah.
Okay, it was handy.
Do not adjust your set.
I am dressed for radio. My computer's dressed for radio, too. Darn thing. Here, Bill's computer's screwed up all the time. He comes in, opens it up.
I'm the smart guy today.
It totally works. Here, I'm busting a move trying to get my computer to... Getting all the, everything all updated. Yep. Nope.
Not the way it is. Hey, we got an exciting show today.
Yes, and I can actually read about it on my phone.
My
technology
has
not totally failed us. Yuck. All right, so we're talking about terrorism. Terrorism, counterterrorism, and all the terrorism in between.
But there really hasn't been any terrorism
this year.
Year there hasn't been hardly any.
So we have a document actually loaded on the website at wethepeopleradio.us that you can see. You can download it, too, if you'd like. We got it from our guest, Bruce Moran.
Yes, you should download it and go to the bottom where it gives you a total of terrorist attacks since January 1st.
Of this year. It's like 640, right?
Yeah. So when people say, oh, gee, the terrorist attacks are really down now.
Right. It's hardly happening at all.
Yeah.
Hardly at all.
We have Claire on the line as well now.
Nice. Okay. Everybody's there. Everybody but my computer is in the game.
put me in, coach.
Exactly. Whoops.
Uh-oh. Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean it.
Somebody's not wearing their safety cone orange shirt.
Apparently, we no longer have Claire.
Oh. Hey, this is.
But we have Bruce.
Is this where we go Cool Hand Luke and we talk about the failure to communicate?
Apparently.
All right. So, Bruce Moran, let's talk about him. He is a national security advisor who focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. You're thinking, this guy sounds familiar. He is, because we have him on periodically. He sends us all sorts of great updates from the White House and stuff like that. And so as a consultant, he works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, and corporations, and us. So there's mostly nobody is left out. So he's working with anybody who's paying attention. He works on special national security projects and defines clear hands-on working solutions for crisis preparedness and crisis readiness scenarios. He is with Security Solutions Technologies. And then it sounds like if I'm multitasking correctly with my ears, Claire Lopez might have been jumped in.
She is.
And this will be the first time Claire's ever been with us when she wasn't driving.
Yes.
Claire is not going through a mountain range today that we know of.
No, I am not. I am stationary today.
Nice. How nice for you, actually. And fun for us. So Claire is going to be our crossover guest. She'll be here for the first hour with Bruce, and she'll be here in the second hour with Dr. Lyle Rapacki. So let's tell you about Claire. And I won't read the whole thing in case people are out there going, stop it. Claire is a strategic policy and intelligence expert with a focus on national defense, Islam, Iran, and counterterrorism issues. So she fits in nicely to this dialogue. Currently a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and vice president of the Intelligence Summit. Formerly was a career operations officer with the CIA, a professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. She's obviously very close to crime because I believe those are her sirens that are going off in the background.
No, not mine.
Not your sirens?
No.
Oh, yeah. Bruce is in Chicago. Sorry, Bruce. Your sirens. Chicago hasn't changed at all. So we haven't heard Bruce yet. Say hi, Bruce. Are you in there?
I'm here someplace.
Yeah, hanging out.
Yep,
we still got your picture up as Hawkeye Pierce, so you'll be providing the comic relief when we're not headbutting the microphone or some other foolishness.
We're having a blues fest here, a lit fest, so it's crowded
nice.
In downtown Chicago. A lot of action going on.
Sounds like a good day to be inside talking on the radio.
And 90 degrees.
God, that's joyous.
We're usually in the 70, high 70s.
See, and it's like 60-something here today. And usually here it's like 115 by now.
I think is indicative of what's going on in the world and how terror and a lot of us think about it is people really don't understand the dynamic of terrorism. As they can look onto your website, just up until June 4th this year, there were 640 incidences. So it's really hard to wrap your mind around the degree and the multitude of terror incidents and how it's impacting people around the world. Last year, there were 1,813, so we're on pace with that, or it could be a little below or a little above, but it's pervasive, and it's brutal. It's ugly. As you know, we're looking at the genocide that's going on in Iraq, Syria. We're seeing all types of savage crucifixions, people are being roasted. All these type of things are part and parcel to what's going on, what we need to stop right now. So if we're looking at President Trump, he was overseas about a week and a half ago, and he started a participatory group of people with the Arab leaders to now lock it down, stop the terrorism. And so we're seeing them, you know, I don't know if anybody knows anything about Qatar, but it's a terror-sponsored, basically, state, and they fund a lot of these groups through their oil. It's right off the, you know, Gulf right there, so they're oil-rich. And the things we're looking at is how do you contain it first, and then how do you stop it? What we're doing in Mosul right now is containing it in Raqqa. They're hitting on the door of the principal ISIS headquarters right now in Raqqa as of yesterday. And then we also have troops there in the Philippines. So we're looking at a lot of different avenues to, you know, stop this jihad. I like to call it jihad and terrorism. And then they look at it from their point of view as martyrdom. So they don't want to look at it as suicide, but they think they're doing something religious in terms of being a martyr, and then I'll let Claire start from there. So,
yeah, that's an interesting point, Claire. What do you do? I mean, how do you control or stop somebody who has that mindset that doesn't care if they get killed in the act?
Well, I mean, at a certain level, the forces of those who are willing to kill and be killed, as the Quran says, must be suppressed forcibly. But I would actually step back from talking about terrorism. We're not fighting terrorism. That's not what this is about. I would even stop talking about it because that is simply one small sliver of the overall jihad that's coming against us, and it's a much smaller part of the overall offensive than the rest of it. Security services, intelligence services, law enforcement need to pay attention to this. We, the rest of us, need to stop focusing on terrorism and begin talking about the overall jihad, the civilization jihad, which is nonviolent, non-kinetic, and what it is doing in terms of infiltration, information operations and subversion inside of the West, Western countries, including our own.
Okay.
Nice. And so how do you do that?
Well, people
have to get smarter.
The first thing to do is to understand the doctrine that inspires these forces of jihad. And the inspiration for jihad, whether it be of the violent kind or the civilization kind, comes directly from Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture. So we first have to say that. We have to understand the enemy's threat doctrine, which derives from the doctrine, the law, and the scripture of Islam. All of our national security senior officials, Pentagon, Homeland Security, intelligence community, you name it, need to go back to school and take courses on Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture, and understand that that is the driving inspiration for those who engage in jihad, whether civilizational jihad or violent kind. After that, then you have to understand how they're coming at us and from which lines of effort. Another way to put that is the way our brilliant friend Steve Coughlin, senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and also the president of Unconstrained Analytics, his company, talks about the Maoist splinter movement theory. And all that means is that the enemy uses different lines of effort to attack what I call the pillars of support of society. And I mean by that academia, the courts, the faith communities, local law enforcement, national government and national security, all of these different pillars of support that keep up a society, a Western society. They have lines of effort coming against them, nothing to do with terrorism. But that is how a society is penetrated, like from within, as their own documents say, and debilitated from within, so that when a society gets to the point of Western civilization in Western Europe, and what we're seeing going on in Britain and France and Belgium and the Netherlands and Sweden, those societies are already corroded from within. They have no more support. They have nothing holding them up anymore. And at that point, then the final push comes from violent jihad, and over they go, and they succumb and submit to Sharia, because, of course, that's the objective. They're not just trying to kill people. That's not what they're trying to do. It's not Genghis Khan and piles of skulls. It is about living people. They want people alive to be under Sharia, Islamic law.
Right. They want to be able to control the society. Now, in what's going on in Britain right now, I think has been accelerated to this point by their previous policies of multiculturalism, which has allowed this vast takeover, if you will, of their society. Is there any coming back from that at this point for them?
Well, I wish them all the best, of course. But I'll go back again to my good friend and brilliant scholar, Steve Coughlin, who talks about what is happening now to Western Europe and also to us as really the continuation of at least a century or more of cultural Marxism, progressivism, that began in the time of President Teddy Roosevelt, if not sooner, and has been developing and extending and expanding ever since inside of our Western societies. This is where ideas about the relativism of the value of different cultures come from, how a concept of multiculturalism can be accepted when there is no more critical thinking to allow discrimination, which is actually a good word,
right?
A discrimination between the good, the better, and the best of societies and of cultures and civilizations. When you no longer have that, then multiculturalism can set in, and you know, everybody's the same as everybody else. Even if you like to cut off heads and marry 6-year-olds, that's okay.
Right.
Right. And we can't talk about it. You know, we're not supposed to talk about it because that makes us mean. We need to take a really quick break, but you can get an idea of where we're headed today. And we have plenty more where that came from. We'll be right back with Claire Lopez and Bruce Moran. We're not talking about terrorism. I like that. We're going to stop talking about it, start talking about jihad, because that's really what's in the news.
Cultural takeover.
We'll be right back.
Thank you.
we're back. Without further ado, we're trying to connect Bruce so he can hear you, Claire. The reason he's not saying anything is he can't hear us. So while we do that, maybe you could continue with that thought before you were so rudely interrupted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was emphasizing the point that unless a people, a civilization, know and value who they are, they will not be capable of defending themselves or that civilization from those who would destroy it. And so we as Americans need to get reacquainted with our foundational documents, certainly our Declaration, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, read more of what the Founding Fathers wrote at the Federalist Papers, for example. And then a more recent book I would recommend is one by Samuel Huntington called Who We Are. That's the name of it, Who We Are. And the book describes who founded this country, who were the settlers and the pioneers and the original people who came to this country, settled it, and from among whom arose the Founding Fathers who then took the 13 colonies and turned them into a country. So it's critical to know who we are, what it is that we value, what are those first things, principles that are so dear to us that we'll fight and die to preserve them. I would suggest that among those for us as Americans are the concept of individual liberty, the idea of government by the consent of the governed under rule of man-made law, equality for all in human dignity under the law. As a matter of fact, our name, we are a republic. That word comes from two Latin words, res publica, the public thing. That public thing is the law. That's what sets us apart from all other places. That's why we are exceptional. Now, the irony of all of this, of course, is that so many of our founding fathers actually began life as British citizens. And we as Americans take much of you know, what went into our foundational concepts and principles from the British, as well as other luminaries of the Enlightenment period in Western Europe. And then, of course, going all the way back, I would say we are also of Athens and of Rome, as well as Jerusalem. Of Athens, because that is the first place where independent city-states took hold and ruled themselves as independent city-states. From the Greeks, we also have concepts of philosophy and humanism and logic and reasoning. Rome, because that, during the Republican period, was the place where civil administration with representation from the population, not equal, but the beginnings of that arose. And then Jerusalem, of course, because our foundational documents are Judeo-Christian based, and Jerusalem, of course, is the place where those concepts arose in first Judaism and then Christianity.
And that always sends the left into complete hysterics.
Yes, well, I wonder how you know, hysterical they'd be if their entire civilization were being swept away. Maybe they wouldn't mind.
Yeah, and it's interesting because all the jihadist guys, whether they come from Pakistan or Iran or wherever they come from, they all are operating on a basis of knowledge of their, you know, like them or not, founding principles, I guess, if you will. They're not looking at anything multicultural. They're not looking to fit in or they're looking to impose what they believe onto everybody else, period.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the inequality of this fight we're in right now. The enemy we face, again, the forces of Islamic Jihad and Sharia, those forces are absolutely rock solid in their beliefs, in their understanding of their own foundational principles, which are completely antithetical to our own. But what I'm contrasting here is the commitment, the devotion, the faithfulness of Muslims to their foundational principles and doctrine. and certainly looking at places in Western Europe and a great deal of the wasteland on American campuses, for example, and in the media in this country, the complete lack of understanding of our foundational principles, allegiance to them, or commitment to preserving them.
And I think probably one place that is more obvious than anywhere is our college campuses today. And look what's going on there. And how did that happen? And how do we get that turned around when these, you know, with these professors? And actually, they're even turning on the professors now. But
well, they turn on the professors, then the professors turn on the professors. I mean, that's, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, our college campuses also have become wastelands. Rather uniformly unacquainted with critical thinking or the Founding Fathers' principles. And I'll go back here then again to cultural Marxism imposed in this country as far back as the 19th century began, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, the Franklin School, all of that infiltrated academia. And then, of course, graduates of that learning from academia went back into academia as professors, but also to media and the government. And so what we have today is that all of the key vehicles of thought and what is supposed to be, you know, the bastions and the repositories of our cultural and civilizational principles and knowledge are all in the hands of those who despise them. And to turn that around is going to take a very serious effort, and it's going to be multi-generational, I think, just as the destruction of those pillars of society has taken generations.
Yeah, and I guess what's really frightening is these kids that are coming out of these campuses today, unfortunately, you're going to come out with an education that has no grounding at all to what this country's really about. Or, you know, I mean, they're even rewriting a lot of these textbooks and excluding, like the Federalist Papers and history about our founding fathers.
They're excluding pieces of history, obviously,
exactly.
Large pieces of history.
And so how, I mean, that's got to have a detrimental effect on our future country.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of our tasks will be to correct the textbooks, correct the mistakes, restore balance to different periods of history and, elements of civilizational background and history and so forth contained in those textbooks. And then also, I mean, this is the responsibility for us who have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, young people in the family, that we do the best that we can to be an influence for the positive for them, no matter what it may be they're getting on the college campuses, but that they receive from the family, from the broader family.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Or any young people that we have contact with, balancing input on these critical subjects. And then finally, I would say we might have some hope in the fact that youth are often, emotional and impressionable and all of those sorts of things, and a lot of them sort of straighten up as they get older.
Well, it's interesting because I have, 14 nieces and nephews, and the bulk of them are out of college. And, you know, they went in, they got their degrees in useful things, they got out, they're working. And those kids never participated in, well, we just aren't those kind of people, but they didn't participate in burning down Starbucks or wearing a mask and, you know, throwing things at the police. They went to schools where some of that was going on, but chose not to participate. So, I mean, by way, for people who don't have anybody in that system, they're not all participating. But I'd be curious to know what you think.
But families do
Oh yeah, that's
have
the
a great deal of responsibility and influence, and we shouldn't minimize that.
No,
anyway.
No, they should take every aspect of that and use it, because the upbringing does count if you make it count. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you. I know we have to take another break here, but I was going to ask you. Yesterday was a Act for America. I think Act for America put a nationwide call out for rallies against Sharia, and I'm not an expert on what they were doing, but I had somebody call me from outside of Sacramento and was really frustrated because they had traffic all tied up and all that. And now this person knows, I mean, familiar with the jihad. I mean, this isn't somebody who's a multicultural, purveyor, and yet felt that it was completely stupid for them to be protesting where they were, because it just isn't, Sharia law isn't something that's going to happen here. It's not a threat, and it's stupid that these people were all tying up traffic to protest something that's never coming.
Well, I mean, for any of us who has been stuck in California, Los Angeles, traffic jams, I sympathize. It goes to show the extent of the educational effort that we need to make. Sharia is Islam. Islam is Sharia. You don't have the one without the other.
And it's not an impossibility.
What?
The idea that would... I mean, don't they have Sharia courts in, like, Dearborn and some of these places? I know they do in London.
Not openly. Not officially. I suspect that in many Islamic centers and mosques, there are informal Islamic tribunals going on, but not openly and not in a public way.
Sure. It's just, I thought it was interesting that the commentary, you know, well, this isn't going to happen here. I don't know why people are even protesting this. It's not an issue here. And I thought...
Well, I'll actually add to that, and that I was doing this on Twitter this morning, actually. The question came up. The Center for Security Policy, again, where I am the Vice President for Research and Analysis online, www.centerforsecuritypolicy.org, or shorter, www.securefreedom.org. We have published now two separate compilations of legal cases, and you can find the references to those at our website, on Sharia, Islamic law, making an entry or a presence inside U.S. courts. We went through hundreds and hundreds of cases. We had to trim it down and bound it somehow. So we decided to look only at the state appellate court level across the United States, just to trim the number of cases down to something manageable. And then we published these two studies, one in, I think it was 2011, and one in 2015. Find them at our website, Sharia in American Courts. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases where Sharia was introduced in some way or other by the defense, the prosecution, the judge, whomever. And it doesn't mean necessarily that Sharia decided the case, but rather that it was introduced in some way to the case. It's already here.
Yeah.
It's already in our courts.
Yeah, it's fascinating that it's even allowed... to come into the case at all. One of the books that we highlight on our site is a book called It's All About Muhammad. That book will give you a lot of insight into Islam. It's basically a biography of Muhammad, but it shows you...
So if you think Muhammad was a peaceful prophet,
yes.
Guess again.
Yeah, guess again. I mean, but it really gives you some insight where this is coming from.
And now we celebrate capitalism for 2 minutes, and we'll be right back.
Underground.
Sounds like a little crazy train, eh?
Nice. Yeah, it's amazing how songs like The Crazy Train start sounding like reality after a while. So, hey, we should say hi to Bruce because he's had sound problems on and off, and we've had him in the cone of silence.
Well, we're that's one of the factors we're looking at, what Claire's talking about. I think that's very important because we're really concerned about what's going on in the college campuses with the professors, the ideology, the pedagogy, you know, the that's the way they're being taught and the impact it's having on them. But I'm looking at it from the other side of the equation. What can we do now from the people who are understanding this to lock it down? And we need to really understand it's hybrid and asymmetrical guerrilla warfare. And it's heavily dutied spycraft trade, clandestine activity, and they're in our country now. College students aren't going to do anything about that. You have to have people on the ground and people understanding what to do in law, you know, with law and order now to handle the situation. President Trump is dealing directly with that, with his law and order program. One of the things I'm looking at also is, what is this, when I'm talking about hybrid, asymmetrical guerrilla warfare? Well, if you look at the Gulf War, that's when we first started, you know, insinuating ourselves in Iraq and Saddam Hussein. But the ideas of what happened at that time and now are completely different. How they're trained, what they come to know, and being a jihadist is completely different. They're more sophisticated, both in the spycraft trade and both in how to assimilate into a culture and then infiltrate. And I want to emphasize that because we need to be aware. We need to look, learn, and listen. I wrote that on the website, so people take a look at that. That's a critical part of what I need to, you know, convey today from my perspective. We'll talk in the intermediate term. I would talk about what Claire is saying in Sharia law, and we got to know that, and it goes back, you know, the Caliphate state. But in terms of a broken arrow situation, what President Trump is dealing with right now, he's delivering. He's making sure our entire intelligence corps, our entire military is focused on stopping this action of the hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare that's happening all throughout Europe. It's unquestionably confounding to them because they don't know what they're doing in terms of how to implement a tactical operational program to make sure it doesn't happen. What we're looking at also is how are they addressing it on the front of it, not on the backside. And what I'm talking about is knee-jerk reactions. It's easy to say when something happens, we're doing our best and then we're going to follow up. It's to prevent it from happening in the first place, and how are you going to prevent it? What are you doing to get it there? And then how are you going to institute programs, law and order, in order to make it effective operationally? And that's where my major concerns are right now. We're in the Ramadan period, and that's ending, I think, June 20th, but that's one of the high, you know, high activities of martyrdom for the jihadists. And we're coming upon our 4th of July. So that's, you know, last year was Bastille for the French when he drove that truck and he mowed down all those people and killed everybody. So these are the kind of things I'm looking at to keep people aware now. The college students, I live where there's, you know, five different campuses, and it's a totally different environment. It's carefree. They don't really think about things like I'm talking about right now. It's not a serious environment, you know, critical thinking, like Claire is saying, it's not really there for this type of situation. So what we have to look at is how do we, as people who are looking at it from the terrorist point of view and how it operationally works, make sure it doesn't happen in the United States.
So you don't think, Bruce, that the college campuses are sort of turning into a kind of a breeding ground for this kind of activity?
Oh, sure, but we can't do anything about that in that respect. We got to make sure that they are informed, but we got to work above them and below them to find out how it's going on. That's what I'm saying. You need operations to be effective where they don't know what they're doing in terms of the
right
relationships they're establishing with people who have already infiltrated them. I think Claire will agree with that. They don't understand that they're there to usurp anything they want to do in terms of helping these people out. through their multiculturalism. We're not there in what we're trying to do on our end. We're trying to lock it down, be effective, and know when it's going on. You can help, you know, on the campuses, sure, but the professors aren't supporting these efforts, especially in, you know, a lot of larger college campuses. They're not geared towards that. That's not their direction.
I guess so, the scary part is they're doing nothing to discourage.
For the intermediate, I would say that's a good goal. For objectives, that's a good goal, but not for tactical operations and implementing programs right now. We have to have more people that are like Claire, like me, that are moving around, looking at things, watching how they're going down, who are they dealing with, looking at how it's happening, who they're happening with, aiding and abetting, and that's the critical factor. How is this all happening, and it's aiding and abetting? That's not always taken a close look at. Look, you know, so.
Sure.
I'm
sure.
Getting a little upset here, so. it's compounding because it's so pervasive and it's so insidious that it has to be addressed in that fashion. You got to take a look at it in a hard way, and the students aren't looking at it that way. You can't rely on them. That's what I'm saying, in that capacity, or the professors.
I know
you have
that
to be part of their organizations and work with them, but you got to work around them more than you're working with them because they don't know what they're doing.
Sure.
In that capacity.
And I know that neither of you can, you know, see the future. At least that's not the way we promoted the program. So if I'm wrong, let me know. But
welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, exactly. That's a much later show. Actually, I'm curious, though, how long before you guys think that the London type of stuff, you know, this really repetitive, seems to be happening a lot, before that sort of thing starts here? How well set up, I guess, do you think they are here in our own country?
They're well established already. So
that's what I was afraid of.
There's no doubt they've infiltrated and they're well established. So that's what I'm talking about. How do we deal with it, like Claire and I and Lyle and different people who are working with law enforcement or, you know, border security? And like President Trump, you know, started the border security program as soon as he got in, and that, you know, cut down on people coming in. But say you cut down on 50% of people coming in. The other 50% coming through are the ones who are more sophisticated.
Sure.
They're the ones that have the money. They're the ones that get the arms. They're the ones that are infiltrating. So you're locking down, but you have to start getting better at it. You have to have 24/7 operations on the border. And then you got to fully implement the border security program, north and south borders also.
Is it?
Because we'll end up in the same situation Britain is or France is, and you can't have it. You can't have it because people are going to suffer, people are going to die, and it's going to be a travesty. This is a very, very tenuous situation we're in.
I'll
leave the floor now. I'll let Claire speak a little bit. So,
well, I would say that in terms of the kind of jihad violence that we're seeing in places like Britain and France and Belgium, we are a number of years away from that, probably a good 5, 7, even 10 years away.
Why is that?
Because of a couple of things. One is that we don't have the geographical proximity to the Middle East that Europe does, which facilitated the influx of so many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Muslims.
Hooray for the Atlantic Ocean.
Into their territories. So when you look at Britain today, it's got, 5 or 6% Muslims? France is well over 10%. Belgium and the Netherlands, maybe around 4%, maybe 5% maximum. So they have much higher levels of Muslims in their populations already. And the United States doesn't have that, like I said, geographical proximity to the source of, you know, from the Middle East and those battlefields and so forth. And those who are here in the United States are coming in through other kinds of programs, immigration, refugee resettlement, and we are currently at approximately 3.345 million Muslims in this country, which amounts to something less than 1% of our population, which is around 315 or 20 million at this point in time. So it is very much a matter of the numbers. And it's also a matter of within those numbers, back to Mao again, the sea in which the jihadis swim. So when you have larger and larger populations of Muslims, you are going to have larger and larger percentages of those who are Sharia adherent, who are willing to offer safe haven and protection and support, logistics and other support to jihadis, and it becomes a numbers game. And, of course, these Western European countries are much smaller than we are to begin with, and their services have simply become completely overwhelmed. They cannot keep up with them anymore. We heard the number 23,000 suspected jihadis in Britain, of which the services had designated something like 3,000 as of the most concern. Well, to put 24/7 surveillance on one person, you know, you need a team of, you know, approaching 20 people round the clock.
Right.
Okay, multiply that by 3,000. Multiply that by 23,000. They can't do it. They have already become overwhelmed. I don't know how they get out of that without mass deportation and incarceration. Those are the only answers. And if you listen to somebody like Paul Weston, who is a leader of a political party in Britain, and a short video he's got up online, look him up, Paul Weston, W-E-S-T-O-N. This is exactly what he says. At this point, they are in such a situation because of the numbers that they probably cannot get out of it without drastic action, and that must include incarceration and deportation of those who are not citizens.
Wow, and that is a drastic measure to take in a population.
That's one way to look at it, but if you look at 9/11, they were here.
Yeah.
And they infiltrated.
Sure.
And what I was conveying earlier is that the hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare has increased their capabilities. You don't have to have the numbers, you just need small amounts of them to work together as cells and infiltrate. So that's what we're working at. And you don't need to have a lot of people go to a shopping mall or a high school, you know, college and just kill people.
Yeah, and what Claire was...
This is a different situation. I'm taking it from an open society, and we're not looking at it from the terrorist point of view. We have to look at it from the terrorist point of view, what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, what their goals are, and what the effects are going to be. And how dramatic they want. They're looking for a large impact. Now they're looking at cars, you know, instead of, you know, maybe airlines and trucks and different areas on how they're going to be using them to attack. But now it's, even if it's a homegrown or a homegrown as part of a cell unit that's being conducted from different parts in the United States, we need to get a handle on it. That's what I'm talking about. You don't need a lot of them. It's the sheer numbers with, Claire's talking about is certainly a factor, but if you take into account its hybrid asymmetrical guerrilla warfare and it's more sophisticated, and they can put them in computers, they can put them in pop cans, and you can blow a side of the building off, you know, so this is the kind of thing. It's much more detrimental, much more monumental decision-making has to be made, and President Trump is trying to get a handle on that and make his message clear to the American people that as long as his executive orders aren't being executed and he's trying the best he can on the borders and Claire's, you know, group is coming in from the, you know, ideological and informational point of view, these are all very important facets in how to get our country turned around. And Claire is absolutely right that it's easier on our side because of the oceans, but it's harder here because nobody's paying attention. So I'm looking at it from the harder side because nobody's paying attention. And we got to get the information out there, and we got to get more people out there and hired to actually do what we need to have done.
Right, right. And unfortunately...
So we have... What Claire's saying is true. What I'm saying is true. That's what I'm saying. We're looking at it from two different points of view. But you have to take a realistic point of view is, are we 5 or 6 years away? 9/11 didn't happen 5 or 6 years away. It happened...
But that was state-sponsored. That was Saudi Arabia and Iran doing that. Al-Qaeda carried it out. But those 9/11
but now it's ISIS and
Al-Qaeda.
You know,
Nusra Front.
I mean,
they
joined forces and they separated. And we don't know who's combined who in the United States. That's what I'm saying, Claire. You know, they're
and he can't
they're working
hear you,
on different levels, and, you know, we need to be well aware of that fact, and I'm not debating a point. I'm just trying to make clear a point that we don't know a lot, and we don't know how they're operationally here and to what degree. We know they're here. We've been infiltrated, and it's a matter of, you know, in downtown here, this young kid about 3 years ago pulled the plug on a bomb that was going to blow up the people in the financial district here. Those are people I knew. He's only 19 years old. 2 years later, they arrested a friend of his for doing the same thing. I mean, they're homegrown, but they're also, they come from a Pakistani group of people.
And they're traveling in packs, obviously. All right, Claire, next hour, we're going to hear all your response to that because you're sticking with us. Bruce has to go hang out in his world, but you're going to stay with us, and we're going to add Lyle Ropacki to the discussion. So thanks a million, you guys. And just for people listening, I want you to know that a lot of the document that Bruce was referencing is on the website. Please join us online and hang with us for the other hour. We're here at wethepeopleradio.us.
Thanks, Bruce.
I'm Kate.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. We're back after that long celebration of capitalism. We had a longer than usual celebration of capitalism. And just in case you were thinking we had turned into all capitalism, no program, we just crushed both commercial breaks into one, mostly because we've been playing. Claire, are you there? Lyle, are you there? Mostly that was what was going on. And we know
you. For whatever reason, it's hard to keep both of them on the phones at the same time.
Those darn phones. They're new and everything, and we're having a hard time working them.
Jihadis.
Well, we talked about using Skype, and, well, you know how that goes. We tried to infiltrate a new technology, and that was a failed experiment. So anyway, we have Lyle on there now, so we can talk to him for 5 seconds while we try to find Claire. And then if they're both on the phone, then they'll both be on the phone. They won't be able to hear each other, and, you know, we'll go back to the previous hour, same deal, different players. But you know what? We like to mix it up for you here. So you can find all of our information about our guests and the commercial-free archive, actually, for anybody that you'd like to forward this to at wethepeopleradio.us. Fun show today, and actually we got smartened up in the first hour. We were talking about terrorism, and Claire told us to stop talking about terrorism. So we changed the name of the show. It's called It's Time to Stop Talking About Terrorism and Start Talking About Islamic Jihad. So that's a much better title, anyway. It's quite a bit longer, but I've got the web space for it. So the first hour we had Bruce Moran from Security Solutions Technology was with Claire Lopez from the Center of Security Policy. So now we're trying to hang Claire over into the second hour and dovetail her in with Dr. Lyle Ropacki, who is Sentinel Intelligence Services. So
okay, nobody hang up.
Nobody move. You know, you'd think just talking to a few people on the phone would be just so easy. No, it's not that easy. It's never that easy. All right, so Claire, can you hear us? You can always hear us, but can you hear Lyle at all?
I can certainly hear you.
Lyle, can
far,
you
so
can
good.
You can you give us the first couple bars of something you know well?
You want me to sing? I can sing.
Oh, yeah.
I can hear Claire, by the way.
I can hear him, too.
All right. Everybody's on.
My God.
Claire's heard me sing. She doesn't want that show hanging up.
She spoke up pretty quick right there. I think you're probably Lyle.
No, I can hear him. I can hear him just fine. So we don't have any script for this hour, which probably explains our fantastic beginning. Claire, you want to kick us off and see where we go this hour? Because you kind of got cut off at the pass in the last one just because of our sound issues.
Yeah, well, we were just sort of discussing in general terms the state of the global jihad, certainly what's going on in Europe, and how we in the United States here are probably a number of years behind where Europe is. For a number of reasons, including just plain numbers of Muslims in our respective countries, and the fact that the United States is at a stage still of civilization jihad. Yes, I mean, there are the terror attacks that do get through, and those are not going to stop. But overall, the state of the jihad in the United States is one of civilization jihad so far. They're not ready to go kinetic as they have in Europe yet. But if we don't get ourselves back on track, we will be following Britain, France, Belgium, Germany, Netherlands.
Is it basically numbers that tips that over?
Well, the tipping point apparently comes, surprisingly, at a rather low level, but around the 3-4% mark of Muslim population within a larger non-Muslim population. That 3-4% Muslim is a tipping point, apparently, at which point the violence increases, the demands, the aggressiveness of those demands for implementation of Sharia and so forth increases drastically.
And you gave us a number in the first hour. Where do we sit right now as far as the U.S. population goes? We're less than a percent?
Right.
Or?
So we have about 315 or 20 million people overall. And of that, approximately according to Pew Research Institute, maybe 3.3, 4, 5 million are Muslims. So that means something under 1% or close to 1%, perhaps, in the United States are Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And yet it seems like the Muslim dialogue in this country right now seems to dominate the news cycle. In fact, I just was listening the other day, which I probably need to stop doing, but they're talking about having Muslim safe spaces now.
Oh, God, yes, that dopey woman.
Yeah, there's just, it's a crazy amount for such a small percentage of the population. It seems like a crazy amount of airtime they get, and all the news agencies seem to want to talk about, and for good reason.
But they also want to talk about how it and give them airtime for how they're being persecuted, blah blah blah. And my guess is that that's a precursor to the rest.
Well, what we have to understand and take a step back and realize, first of all, is. What is the enemy threat doctrine? It is the doctrine, law, and scripture of Islam. And what is their objective? It's very simple. A global Islamic state, call it a caliphate, or Shiites might call it an imamate, under rule of Islamic law. And they achieve that through jihad. That's it. It's that simple. But people don't want to accept that, and there comes the debate. But once we understand what they seek, and the means they use to seek it, then we can begin to formulate our own national security strategy to counter it, but in a realistic way, understanding what it is they fight for and why.
And that's a huge consideration.
Yeah, and that's where I think we all need to smarten up a little bit on.
Because people are totally lulled into this whole religion of peace fantasy.
Well, it certainly wasn't based on
that. I hear
that.
Lyle taking a deep breath.
Yeah. I just took a cup of coffee, swig of coffee. You know what Claire says is absolutely 100%. I have nothing to add to that part. What I'm looking at, and Claire and I have discussed this along with others in the field, is the subtlety, and yet maybe not so subtle, but the subtlety by which our little communities, villages, towns are being taken over. I just got a letter yesterday. I've been gone for a couple of days, so I'm sorry, I'm behind the eight ball. I just got a letter yesterday from a person in a small community asking if I could help them or direct them somewhere because in their community they have a social worker at the local school who's a Muslim. The administrator or vice principal, I don't have it figured out yet because the person wrote it in a vague way, but the social worker at the school is a Muslim. The vice principal or the administrator at the school who authorizes homeschooling and reviews homeschooling progress is a Muslim. The CPS worker at the school is a Muslim. The nurse practitioner after school, and also in the ER, the local walk-in emergency room, is a Muslim, and the doctor at the ER is a Muslim. They also have a couple of other Muslims in very key positions within the community government there. And so what I'm seeing happen, and I know Claire and I have discussed this, because we're seeing it in elected officials also at the local and even state level, is that they are making inroads at a very subtle way, under the radar, in all the key positions that literally have a lot to do with day in and day out activities in our lives. Have they really sprung their Sharia yet? No, not yet. But when you look at what Claire said, 3% is very, very low. I agree, in the overall population. But what they've done through Civilization Jihad is they've gone after very key positions in our communities, and these positions have authority over our day-to-day lives, and they're infiltrating all of these different positions, and therefore they're influencing the change of our culture.
And I think a really classic example of that is the mayor of London.
Well, what I was going to say is that what Lyle is saying is so very important, and I'm going to go back to what he talked about, the school and the local health services clinic emergency room. We just had break into the national news within the last couple of months, a federal case of female genital mutilation, FGM, in the state of Michigan. It's being investigated, and we can go into more detail about all of that and the circumstances surrounding it. Suffice to say that FGM is a federal crime, it's a felony, and has been since 1996. But when you have Muslims in all of these key positions at an elementary school, at the clinic, as the social worker, a Muslim child, a girl, little girl, is never going to have a chance to even be seen by a non-Muslim doctor or social worker, perhaps her entire childhood up till the age of 18. And so the only chance for finding out about such atrocities as this Muslim doctor butcher in Michigan is, as I think happened in that case, a whistleblower or something like that. So, again, what Lyle said is so important to understand, that when they get into positions like that, they can control a lot of things and keep a parallel Muslim society separate from the broader host society. You're thinking they're part of it, they're integrated. No, they're not. They're living in separate parallel societies in which women and children, little girls, may be deprived of access and protection under constitutional law.
That's really an amazing point. I most folks would think, well, gee, they're doctors, they're nurses. That's they're integrating, but the big picture looks like it's a whole different game.
Well, if you line it up like that,
yeah. Yeah, when you look at the real
counselor, the local clinic. I mean, why? That keeps the kid from ever getting outside that loop.
That's right.
Well, this is one of the things Claire and I and others in the field have begun to discuss in rapid succession, because we're seeing it spread very quickly. Claire will correct me if I'm wrong.
Provided she can hear
what
you.
What I? Huh?
Nothing. Just kidding. I said, provided she can hear you.
No, that's really, providing she can hear me. That was really neat that she even agreed with me. That's big. Now I feel great.
and she said, you're never wrong, so, the bar is like way high.
Oh, yeah, man, it's like,
fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to tell my wife, Claire agreed with me. we've been discussing this and looking at different reports for about a year, I think, Claire, isn't it? About a year and a half?
Maybe so, yeah.
About a year and a half, because I became aware about a year and a half ago of in a couple of states in the West, Western states, a couple of the states in the Western states, let me be clear like that, where Muslims had gone ahead and invited legislators to Ramadan dinners. On the surface, it doesn't seem like anything, and indeed, the letter, the actual correspondence to the state legislators in these states was, hey, you know, we just want to reach out and let you see something. It's a cultural exchange. Well, very innocent. And the legislators went. Well, then they went again to another event and then another event. Then they were partially funded to go to Turkey to participate in something. And what I began to see here...
Set the hook.
Huh?
Yeah, it's like setting the hook.
Well, pretty much. And that really caught our attention. And I talked to Claire about it. I talked to a couple of others I won't name. Claire knows what I'm saying. Because I wanted their counsel on it. And what I was seeing is an extreme seductiveness taking place. I think I invented a word. But they were being seduced at the local city council level, at the county level with commissioners or boards of supervisors, up to the state legislators. And at these local levels, they were implementing their cultural ways under the radar, not drawing any attention, and clearly not wanting to be adversarial, if you will allow me that. Claire can jump in on this. But they were doing everything they can to show that, no, we're a part of all of this. We're just a different culture. We have a little bit different belief system, but we're all together, kind of a kumbaya.
Yeah, we all agree with each other.
Yeah.
I mean, this is exactly the way it works. This is the very definition of civilization jihad.
Yes.
And I was talking in the earlier hour about how the forces of Islam are attacking our pillars of support of society, as I call them.
Yes.
And among those pillars, as I said back then, are academia, the courts, and our legal system. Certainly, government at all levels, civic government, and all the way from local city council to federal, congressional, law enforcement, local law enforcement, national security, media, so forth. And a society, a civilization, does not just fall by kinetic attack. It falls because it's already been hollowed out. It's already been debilitated from within by civilization jihad, and this is the way it goes, what Lyle is just talking about. The seemingly innocent invitation to local civic leaders, and they'll also go for the faith community leaders, journalists and others, to aim information operations at them, propaganda, if you will, that gradually brings those targeted people into a relationship of friendship with the local jihadis. We call them jihadis in suits because, no, they don't have great big bushy beards and they don't have suicide vests on, but they're jihadis nonetheless. They're just wearing suits and they're deceptive and they're very, very good at what they do, to the point that when they begin to push for concessions, as they do, to Sharia, to introducing Sharia, to allowing an element of Sharia, whatever it may be, special foot baths at the airports. By the way, there are no foot baths in the Middle East in the airports, only in the West.
Oh, really?
Do we actually have them?
You know, prayer times to get off of work and go take time off to go pray. A special, you know, time off for kids from school. These are all incremental demands that are made step by step, very slowly. They don't care if it takes 300, 500 years to do this. They're on that timetable.
Sure.
So it's like starter jihad. And
yeah, once it starts, you can't take it away.
Made by those who have been roped into relationships like Lyle is just describing.
Well, we've learned that what Claire's now saying, too, it sounds like we're tag-teaming. In a way, we are, because we're seeing this unfold across the nation now. Enough, a significant number of Muslims from various countries have come into America now. They've established their own little territories, and now they're branching out. Another example, which is one that she did mention, is that they're now working at the local level with law enforcement, and they're inventing, if you will, I mean, they're basically inventing Islamic law enforcement advisory boards. And that's sort of a name. I changed the name a wee bit, just a wee bit, because I have to protect the cities and other communities. But there are local law enforcement advisory boards. And what they do is they sit with the chiefs of police and command staff people to, quote unquote, bring a cultural awareness to law enforcement as to the Islamic ways. Well, when you get into Islamic or Sharia law, there's a number of things our Western law does not accept, but they do in Sharia. And now there is a tug of war taking place under the radar, very calm, with people in $1,000 suits, and I'm not making that up. Claire can testify to this. They can speak better English than I do. They went to very advanced schooling. They're more westernized, if you'll allow me that, just to draw a word picture, if I may, than many of us. And they come in and they start to teach and allow law enforcement to begin to understand and reach out and touch the Islamic community in a more gracious manner, if you will. Well, what they're doing is literally presenting policies and rule changes. They've affected some law at the local level, usually policy, not state law, not yet. But they're working on changing policies, law enforcement policies, investigatory policies, the way you investigate crimes. They are working at developing no-go zones within communities in the United States. Here in the United States, they're working on developing communities where law enforcement will no longer go into it. They want their own law enforcement in adherence to a Sharia law. This sounds absolutely far-fetched, but it is happening as we're talking about it.
Well, if you don't think that's far-fetched, what other culture or religion is allowed to do that in this country or has done it and set up no-go zones?
None.
And here's the difference. Lyle's absolutely correct in everything he just said, and we've been in places, as I teach courses to law enforcement in Arizona and many other places, along with John Guandolo of Understanding the Threat, understandingthethreat.com, for those who might want to take a look at the website. The local law enforcement come up and tell us about these incipient or developing no-go zones, maybe not as full-fledged as something like a Molenbeek in Brussels, but it's headed in that direction. The difference is that you may have ethnic communities in many cities, the Slovenian, the Hungarian, the Polish, the that, where people gather together, and this goes back, you know, maybe two or three generations to the first immigrant community that came from, let's say, Eastern Europe to the United States, and there they have, kept customs of music and food and cuisine and things like that. They hold festivals in the summertime typically. It's a very different thing than a community which typically is centered around a mosque or Islamic center, which we know from Islamic doctrine and the history of Muhammad's own biography that a mosque is essentially a command and control center for jihad. It is a place for training, indoctrination, and the storage of weapons, as the West European dismay. It is also a place which is used to expand outwardly to establish a community where the businesses, as well as the residences, are now owned and occupied by other Muslims. And then from that population is gleaned financial contributions to strengthen the community.
Correct.
And all of this sounds perfectly fine and lawful and would be if the ultimate intention, as we know because they've told us so, were not the substitution of the U.S. Constitution and the laws derived from it with Sharia.
Yeah. All right, we've got to take a quick break here. We've put capitalism off long enough. We've got to go back and visit them. They took the lion's share at the beginning, but we've got to get back to that. So we're here chatting with Lyle Rapacki and Claire Lopez, and we're not talking about terrorism. We're talking about Islamic Jihad, and that really is not an impossibility in our country, as we're hearing today. And if you have friends who think it is, please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll have a commercial-free archive up this afternoon. But we still love capitalism, even though it's commercial-free.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give-a-damn's busted. Lurks within. Smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces tell lies, and I got proof. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Can you dig it?
And we're back. The old Smiling Faces song, it always comes up on this topic. Claire, got a question for you. Had somebody kind of call in, you know, we've got all the phone lines jammed up, so, and I had seen that you tweeted this yesterday, 17 hours ago, that somebody had posted, Sharia was banned in the United States in 1952, the McLaren, what do you call it?
McCarran-Walter
Act. McCarran-Walter Act, yeah. Okay, so, you had said that, no, Sharia has never been banned in the U.S., alien law is only a problem when it conflicts with the U.S. Constitution. So, if people think that's going to save us, why is that not true?
Why is what not true?
Is the 1952 McCarran-Walter Act, I mean, is that the secret weapon to this?
No, nothing to do with Sharia.
It has nothing to do with it.
I don't know why they would have said that. It does not ban Sharia, period.
It keeps coming up. So,
I just don't know where they're getting that from.
Okay. So I just thought we would get, because I was reading about it earlier.
So that, what does that act do?
As I recall, and I don't have it in front of me, but I believe that's the act.
I have a little blurb here if you want me to read it.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Yeah, because I was looking at the, I actually had the post up. I sort of snaked you there.
I was
ahead. It says, Chapter 2, Section 212, is the prohibition of entry into the U.S. of alien, if the alien belongs to an organization seeking to overthrow the United States government by force, violence, or other unconstitutional means. Any immigration without assimilation is invasion by enemy forces.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, would that, I mean, these people often, they're not necessarily coming here.
They're extrapolating. People who read that and make the decision or reach the conclusion that somehow that bans Sharia are kind of extrapolating from what the law actually says. And of course, the law does not say anything about banning Sharia.
Okay, because, yeah, this post, I've seen this before. And it always, the big header is, Islam is not allowed in the USA.
No, that's not true.
Good. Well, I just, not to put too fine a point on it, but this does come up a lot, even on Twitter as recently as 17 hours ago. So, okay, so that's not going to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves again. Darn it.
Something that Claire mentioned about the Michigan doctor that they have now uncovered that was doing the genitalia mutilation. It's over 100 girls. I don't know if you knew that, but over 100 young girls have now been recorded as undergoing that custom or ritual, depending on how you want to use the word. That's just atrocious. And that's an example, just one example. And I think Claire and I could give you multiple examples of how this stuff is infiltrating our culture, our belief systems, our values, et cetera, et cetera. And they have no intention of stopping. Would you agree,
well,
Claire?
Well, exactly. Now, what we do have as federal law is a 1996 ban on FGM, female genital mutilation. And so the case in Michigan that was uncovered a few months ago involves a Muslim doctor, a woman, and a clinic owner and his wife. So those three people all are under arrest at the present time. The case is being investigated by the FBI and the Department of Justice precisely because there is an alleged violation of a federal law, not to mention the fact that you've got cross-border or interstate trafficking of minors by their mothers from Minnesota to Michigan to have this felony perpetrated against them. So all of that has brought in the federal law officials. But what I will say, and this gets back to Islam and Sharia, is that we have long known that Sunni Islamic law either obligates or condones and approves FGM explicitly under Sharia, under Islamic law, on the Sunni side of things. Depending on the school of jurisprudence, it's either obligatory under Shafi law or condoned and approved under the other schools. Now, what we found out in Michigan is that there is an obligation, obligation for FGM under a Shiite Islamic sect, a subsect of the Ismaili Shiite Muslims called the Dawoodi Bohra sect. It's primarily concentrated in western Pakistan, but there are communities now here in the United States, and as a matter of fact, because of an online website, we can look it up. There are 22, at least 22 listed Dawoodi Bohra Islamic centers and mosques around the United States, and in each one of those communities, because FGM is obligatory for the Dawoodi Bohra Shiite Muslims, guaranteed there will be networks and cases of FGM being performed in those communities.
Oh, my God.
Number one place for law enforcement to start looking to prosecute this, to investigate and prosecute the Dawoodi Bohra communities around the United States.
And that's in Farmington Hills, Michigan, if you want to really get specific.
That's where this case, yeah.
No,
yeah, Farmington Hills. Now, one of the things they're going to argue, and we're talking about cultural here,
right,
how our culture is being seductively changed. The defense is going to take the position that this is religious practice and that these girls were not harmed, that they did undergo a religious ritual, and therefore, on religious grounds under the First Amendment, nothing should be done to them. That's what they're going to argue. You watch. And again, this is bringing a different culture into the United States, and they're using our laws when it's applicable to them to continue their own program. It's sort of like what happened yesterday across the country. I don't mean to change the subject, but there was 28 cities where they had Americans come up and stand publicly against Sharia law, and they had rallies. They had one here in Phoenix.
They had one in Roseville in Sacramento. We did talk about it first hour because
I had somebody
who was really bugged about it because they felt that it was unnecessary. And
well, what's interesting that the person who thought it was unnecessary, whoever that was, would be in agreement with the Muslims and CAIR, C-A-I-R.
But they really aren't. They just don't understand that it's an actual issue.
Well, the First
Amendment... come out now. CAIR has come
out. In no way, shape, or form permits violation of federal law. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. But you see, when Americans stand up for their constitutional rights against organizations like Hamas, CAIR, etc., all of a sudden, the peaceful, calm, friendly, obedient, cheerful, thrifty Muslim community rears its head and goes back to their Quran and their teachings, and you can see it in full color. Other than that, they're very quiet. They are continuing to infiltrate at the local levels and bring their culture, their beliefs, their values, etc., into the local level, schools, hospitals, all the things we've already talked about, and more, to change our culture from inside out. It's kind of like a Trojan horse.
Sure. And it's one little piece at a time.
Pretty much.
Until
kind of like how do you eat an elephant? You know,
yeah,
a little
exactly.
bite at a time. And like Claire said, it doesn't matter to them if it takes 300 years. They don't care. They have one goal only, and that's to establish a caliphate. Americans historically are not that directed in, or focused, if you will. We have multiple things going on. We have a very blessed lifestyle, so we have multiple things that occupy our time. That's a plus, and it's also a negative. In this case, these people are razor-focused. They have one goal, and that's to establish a caliphate. Anything that gets in its way, they'll stop, reconnoiter, and figure out how to work through that blockage to continue on to their goal. Nothing will stand in the way of their goal.
No, and it's all connected. The social life, the religious life, the work life, the neighborhood life, it's all the same thing, where a lot of times ours is separate.
Yeah, and Americans are very forgiving people. We're very
accepting.
I mean, we have our thugs and other things, but we're a very forgiving people by nature. And so when somebody stands up and declares that, well, this is my religion and my religious practices, we give them that latitude. And Claire's the expert on this part. I'm not. To me, Islam is not. It's got religion connotations connected to it, but it's a political movement.
It's a big-time political movement.
Political and legal, because Sharia is legal. But they intend to establish a political environment, a caliphate, a way of running a government, if you will, outside of the Constitution of the United States. Any religious practices they can throw in there to make it look good, they'll do that. But to me, Islam is not a religion. Now, I stand corrected, Claire, if I'm wrong on that. But to
it's
more of a political and military.
You throw in aspects of worship of a deity does not automatically give you protection under the First Amendment of the Constitution.
That's true, too. If
in the doctrine of this belief system are elements antithetical to, contradictory to, the U.S. Constitution and the laws derived from it.
So when we come back with you guys, we want to talk about how we turn this corner, how we get tough with it, because there are a lot of people who do get it at some level, but somehow we're going to have to mobilize those elements before we get mowed down by these guys. And I guess I meant that figuratively, but I guess literally works for them too. So quick break here to thank capitalism again and celebrate its existence. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back. Song enough. It wasn't funny when I was younger, but it's kind of funny now, in a creepy sort of way.
Yeah, creepy kind of way.
Yeah. Okay, you guys, I know we only have 6 minutes or something, but what we were all talking about here in the studio on the break is, what's the deal with Dearborn, Michigan? I mean, these guys are they literally have their own universe going on there, and they seem to be completely getting away with it. So how do we stop that from...
That the United States federal level, state level, municipal level, allows sovereign territory to essentially secede from the writ of law of the United States, that is ceding sovereignty of our country to something that is not constitutional. And this is partly how certain places in Europe got to where they are today. I don't think we want to follow Molenbeek or Tower Hamlets in London or any of these other no-go zones that they've got in France and elsewhere.
No, and we're very, very close to that in Dearborn. I mean, it's really gone over the edge there.
Well, over following with what you just said, in Cedar Riverside, that's a community, Cedar Riverside in Minneapolis, they now have Sharia cops patrolling the neighborhood. Local law enforcement is aware of this, and they're monitoring it, but they have not taken any steps to intervene. There is a mistake right there.
Oh, sure.
Why would they do that?
And I'll defer to Claire, who's more expert on this.
Exactly right. And I've been to that neighborhood. I've talked to local to law enforcement, local law enforcement,
right,
who corroborate what Lyle just said. Are they afraid? Are they afraid of the former Justice Department of the United States coming down on them like a ton of bricks if they try to enforce U.S.
law? I think it's that, Claire. Like we've all talked about with others in the field, not only are they worried historically about the Department of Justice coming down on them, but now they've got a city manager, a chief of police, and others. I'm not saying in that particular neighborhood or in that community, but what is taking place, and we can prove, I believe, over and over again, that the CAIR, C-A-I-R, and other forms of the Islamic movement have infiltrated and really affected city managers, city councils, chiefs of police. And so now the officer on the street is very aware that if he goes ahead and interferes with this stuff, he's looking at a career change.
Oh, yeah.
Does that make sense?
This is where we've got
to be fired.
Many police
he's
departments
gonna be fired
around the country,
or worse.
And
he's
going to
be brought up on charges.
The new administration and new Attorney General Jeff Sessions will help to turn that around.
We pray so, yes. But so you were talking about Michigan and here in Minneapolis. I mean, what we already have happening in Dearborn and in other communities is what we've been talking about this last hour. You're beginning to see it now come to the surface. It's been under the radar. It's percolating, and now they're probing. They're checking to see how far they can get away, and that's why they've infiltrated schools, all sorts of local hospitals, local emergency centers. They're working their way throughout the culture, and when they feel comfortable enough, or that they've accomplished enough of a change in that little community, it'd be a 3-mile radius, then they go ahead and begin to openly enforce Sharia law, and they wait to see exactly what kind of pushback will they get.
And that's exactly how it works, is test the waters, test the waters, test the waters. And each time, you get a little more.
Correct.
Let me ask you, Claire, a kind of a specific question here. The Free Iran movement, the people who are supporting Miriam Rajavi.
Yes.
Where do they fit in all this? Are they? I realize this is very simplistic, but are they good guys or bad guys?
A whole other show, I think. But
I know.
In brief. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 brought to power the Ayatollah Khomeini, his successor, supreme leader today, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and ushered in a Sharia and a jihad government. And I'm not saying that's straight out of the Iranian constitution.
Right, right.
So various opposition groups naturally have sprung up against this horrific jihad, human rights abusing, terror supporting, nuclear weapons developing regime. And among those, the largest, oldest, and I think best organized is the Democratic National Council of Resistance of Iran movement. Their website, National Council of Resistance of Iran, you can find that there. It is an umbrella political group of which one of the key members is the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which is one of the oldest opposition groups in Iran. It originally sprang up to oppose the Shah, who likewise was not was dictatorial and was not democratic, but certainly was no jihadi. And that group today continues its struggle to oppose and to change the regime in Iran. It is supported by many top Americans like Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani, Tom
Ridge. Right, and are they kind of good?
So, forth.
so they're not bad guys posing as good guys necessarily?
No, not at all. These are the best of the best. These are Iranian patriots.
We've had them on our show, so
many
I just thought we'd
American
check.
American patriots now in exile, of course, from Iran.
Great. Have
become American citizens, too. But seek for American national security, the regime change in Iran, because of the threatening, not just human rights abuses, which are horrific, but the development of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, the ballistic missiles to deliver them, terror and jihad expansionist activities across the Middle East.
Then we'll continue to support them and chat with them online, and on the radio. We've had them on our show. I just thought, probably a good idea to run that by you before we accidentally blundered into something stupid.
Well, we're totally out of time.
And they have to air a ball game, so we have no overlap. So thanks, you guys. We really, really appreciate it. It was
Thank
way
you.
Too fast, and we want to do it again.
Thank you for having me.
You guys
Thank
have
you
a...
You too, Lau.
You guys enjoy your other time zones, evening and whatnot, and have a great one. You've been listening
Thank
to
you.
We the People. We will have your archive up this afternoon, commercial-free in a couple hours. WeThePeopleRadio.us.